Let's get together, talk about the movies that we saw this week. We'll have discussions, talk film news, we'll laugh a lot and act like geeks. Sometimes we'll have a guest or two, sometimes it's just the two of us. Let's crack some jokes and tell some folks to come along and hang with us!
Mike and Mike go to the movies. Mike and Mike go to the movies.
Yeah!
You have chosen wise.
It's the annual Mike and Mike Oscars discussion episode. I'm Mike Smith, and joining me as always is a man who knows in his heart that Nicolas Cage appearing at the Oscars was thanks in part to our efforts.
Mike DiGricio.
How are you doing today, Mike?
I'm doing great. I think I almost direct quote texted you that during the ceremony. It's like, we made this happen.
Yeah, I definitely had that thought when Nicolas Cage first appeared. And then you texted me, and yes, it seemed like a confirmation that yes, indeed, if we didn't launch the complete works 9 years ago to talk about the films of Nicolas Cage, I don't think he'd be standing there on that stage the other night, you know?
I think so. I think that's really, so you're welcome, everybody.
Yes. How you doing today, Mike? What's been going on?
Not a whole lot. Living the Helldivers 2 life still. So thank God we're mostly discussing the Oscars because I have barely anything else to talk about. Managed democracy must be spread. And so that's what I've been doing most of my life.
Sure. I still have yet to play Helldivers 2. I'm sure it's a good time.
It's great. Great time. What have you been up to, Mike?
Yeah, not too much. I went to go see Oppenheimer again this weekend, the Roxy, the Indian Theater in my house in Missoula, Montana, where I also work. Brought it back on 35mm, kind of in anticipation, because we all kind of were like, it's going to win Best Picture.
Yeah, come on.
So we brought it back on 35. I went to go see it, and I think really underrated it the first time it came out. I really enjoyed it. I saw it in IMAX then, but did not get to see it on 35. And yeah, the film print was beautiful. And I was really kind of taken in by the editing and the score and how they all kind of come together and create this movie. It rules. I'm actually pretty glad it won Best Picture. You know, I was never going to begrudge it winning Best Picture. I was like, yeah, this is a good movie. I'm happy with this.
Yeah.
You know, that's fine. But it is a stronger Best Picture winner than I had previously thought. So happy about that. And then of course we had the Oscars on Sunday and I went to watch them at the Roxy, the Indie Theater near my house in Missoula, Montana, where I also work.
Yeah. There's like a whole thing you guys do there.
Yeah. So every year the Roxy, we do an Oscars viewing party, which is free to attend. And we can't really legally call it an Oscars viewing party. It's, you know, Hollywood's biggest night.
Right.
Like the Super Bowl rules basically, you know? And so, yeah, I have gone there every year since 2018 or every year that it's been happening, because in the year 2021 it didn't happen for obvious reasons. Those reasons
Why?
Being COVID.
What was going on?
But I've been going since I've moved to Missoula. It's always a super fun time. And it's only grown in that time. Like more and more people kind of know about it and find out about it and stuff. And this year, the tickets were sold out weeks in advance.
Nice.
And then part of that is because the Roxy had a very specific connection to the Oscars this year, which is that Lily Gladstone, who was nominated for Best Actress for Killers of the Flower Moon. I'm not sure if I've mentioned this in the podcast before. I must have at some point,
it's
right?
It's only every time we talk about the fact that she's nominated for the Oscar.
Fair enough. Lily Gladstone, nominated for Best Actress, used to work at the Roxy. Is from Montana, went to the University of Montana, and worked at the Roxy about 10 years ago, and then left. I think she left the Roxy to make Certain Women. Like, she got cast in Certain Women, and that's when she left the theater. I might have the timeline a little bit wrong on that, but it's right around there that she left. Like, there are people on staff that I work with now who still know Lily. I met Lily 2 years ago at the Montana Film Festival, which was really cool. People who still know her, still talk to her, still text her. I was talking to one of my other coworkers, Ken, who was like, yeah, if you look through my text history with Lily Gladstone, it's just really boring, because it's just us talking about the film camps that the Roxy is putting on.
Amazing.
I took over a job and I was like, well, I gotta, I have to get all the details from you. Oh, do you have this person's email?
Right. Just work stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Which is kind of funny. But yeah, so obviously the Oscars viewing party at the Roxy was very abuzz for that reason. reason, because we were all very excited that Lily Gladstone was getting recognized, that she was nominated, and it really seemed like she could win. That was the thing. Like, it really felt like that was the thing. I mean, it was a weird, like, all the other acting categories felt pretty predetermined, right? It was, you know, Cillian Murphy was going to win for Oppenheimer. Robert Downey Jr. was going to win. Devine Joy Randolph was also going to win for The Holdovers. Like, those, like, just based on the previous 80 award shows that lead up to the Oscars.
Yeah.
That felt about right. But Best Actress was kind of up in the air because Lily Gladstone won about half of the awards leading up to it, and Emma Stone won the other half. And most people, I think, were kind of leaning towards Lily Gladstone, partially for the historic nature of her win. She was the first Native American person to be nominated in the category, and so that would have been kind of a big thing. But yeah, unfortunately, she did not win. And watching that at the Roxy was quite an experience.
I can't imagine. I mean, like, watching it at home just alone was deflating. So, like, yeah. I can't imagine, like, the hometown hero not winning.
Yeah, it was. So, I mean, the event itself, which we had at the Roxy, was awesome. Credit to Fergie for putting that on. But it was, you know, there was food. There was a lot of people were dressed up. But there's trivia. We all had our Oscar ballots that went in there, which I tied for like third place in our staff Oscar ballot. I couldn't win. Like, I wasn't allowed to compete in the actual, right, like, among the plebeians. But
Gen Pop.
I tied for like third place in a staff Oscar ballot, but I was at a different Oscar ballot with Nick, a frequent guest of the show. He, like, kind of created the spreadsheet with him and a few friends, and me and him tied for first place.
Nice.
So I'm happy about that, at least. But yeah, we had Oscar ballots, we had trivia, we had food, we had all this kind of stuff that was happening, and we had, like, archways that were, like, donated lilies, like, for Lily Gladstone and all that stuff. And, you know, we were hyping about it throughout the night, and all of us felt pretty confident going in Lily Gladstone was going to win. Like, we felt pretty good about it.
I think most people did.
Yeah, I think so. I think she was, like, kind of, even though it was very, very close, like, you know, throughout the whole race, she seemed like the favorite to win. Instead, it was the person who was in the favorite, Emma Stone.
Hey. Whoa.
But yeah, no. And when it got to the Best Actress category, which is at the very end of the night, right before Best Picture, there was cameras set up in the theater to try to capture the moment, like the people's reaction, like when Lily won, or even if she lost, like, there, you know, there'd be some kind of reaction. The local news came by to get people's reactions and stuff. And then the moment it was announced, like, people were hyped the entire time. Like, they did a whole thing where, like, five actors came out to introduce each nominee. And, like, you know, once they got to Lily, like, people were like, oh yeah, it was very exciting. And then just crickets. Like, as soon as Michelle Yeoh announced that Emma Stone won Best Actress, the entire theater just fell silent.
Wow.
I have seen that reaction once before watching the Oscars at the Roxy, and it's when Green Book won Best Picture. Was
when that
happened. Yeah, that's
wow.
That was definitely a flub. Yeah, so it was a super fun night, and it was a little bit deflating for that reason. Otherwise, I thought the ceremony was pretty good. I had a good time otherwise with the show. But yeah, I mean, Mike, you still haven't watched The Killers yet, have you?
I have, yeah, I did.
Oh, you did? Okay, yes.
Yeah, it was in my top 10.
Oh, okay, yeah. I think I'm conflating it with The Irishman in my mind. You still
watched The Irishman.
The other 3.5-hour Martin Scorsese epic.
Yes, correct. I'll get there one day.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, so you've seen Killers. Have you seen Poor Things yet, just out of curiosity?
I have not. I haven't seen, I guess let's maybe list the best pictures for me, because I don't know all of them off the top of my head, but I have not seen most of them.
Okay, so the movie's nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars. Oppenheimer, which one? You saw that.
I saw that.
American Fiction.
Did not see that.
Okay. Anatomy of a Fall.
Did not see that. Didn't finish that, unfortunately. That was, I was having technical difficulties, and then I was just like, fuck this.
Man.
I think I talked about that, where I was like, oh, I'm just going to watch. I'm gonna watch Barry Lyndon. It was like another 3-hour movie. Like, I had every movie I was gonna watch that day ended up being like two and a half plus hours.
Right.
And I think that was when I just settled on watching Killers of the Flower Moon. Like, if I'm gonna do it, I might as well watch this one.
Might as well get this out of the way now.
Yeah,
highly recommend Anatomy of Fall. I think you would really love it.
Yeah, I mean, the first, I think it was like 45 minutes, I was like really into it. So yeah. I definitely just haven't gotten back around to it, but that might have been like my pick, you know.
Okay, if you had finished it.
If I had seen it, yeah. Or finished it.
Okay, so Oppenheimer, American Fiction, Anatomy of a Fall, Barbie, you've seen, right?
Did see that, yes.
Okay. The Holdovers, you've seen. That was your number one.
That was number one.
Yeah. Killers of the Flower Moon, you've seen. Maestro.
Just 0 inches. Doesn't move the needle at all for me. But have not seen it, no.
Fair enough. Past Lives.
Have not seen it, but I'm sure I would have loved it. I'm sure I would have been like, I love your story of that random woman next to you just barely making it to the credits before a complete breakdown.
Yes, that was pretty fantastic. Yeah, Past Lives, my number one of the year. And then there was Poor Things, which you haven't seen, and The Zone of Interest, which I assume you haven't seen yet, right?
I have not, no.
Okay, so you've seen Oppenheimer, Barbie, Holdovers, Killers. You saw 4 out of 10. That's not bad.
That's better than I do most years.
Yeah, that's better than I think most people do in general, right? I've seen 10 out of 10. And I think of the Best Picture winners, I think this is a really strong, it was a really strong year for film in general. And I think this is a really strong lineup. Like, I think there's none of these movies are movies that I would consider bad, you know, which for the Oscars, it's pretty good. Pretty solid.
10 out of 10? Impossible.
Yeah, impossible. But I think 8 out of 10, I think, are movies that I think are very, very, very good to great. And then the other two, which would be Maestro and American Fiction, I think are pretty good. They're solid. They're fun. I did not dislike my time watching either one of them, you know?
Okay. I like it.
Yeah. So there was that. But yeah, but I do think, I saw Oppenheimer again on 35mm, underrated it when I first came out. And I think it winning Best Picture, it makes sense. It was kind of a foregone conclusion, you know, like months ago, everyone was like, yeah, it's going to be Oppenheimer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just kind of like, it felt like a culmination of things coming together. Like, you know, it is Christopher Nolan. It's, it's sort of like a his time kind of thing where it's like, yeah, he's been making great movies for 25 years. It's time to give Christopher Nolan the Best Director and Best Picture. It was also, you know, a historical biopic. It's also a movie that was a huge hit. And that's something that the Oscars don't often get to reward anymore. And so with all of those things kind of combining, it makes sense. Oppenheimer, it's Best Picture. Sure.
What do you need, a roadmap?
Yeah.
I thought it was really good. Just back to the ceremony in general, I thought it was pretty solid. You know, the Oscars, as we chart every year that we've done this episode, I don't really care anymore. You know, like, I used to be super into it. I used to stay up late. That was like the night, you know, you could stay up late because they used to especially, they moved them up an hour, I think, this year, right?
So yes.
End around midnight on the East Coast and stuff.
Right. That's one of the nice things about being in Montana now is that the Oscars started at 5 o'clock.
Wild.
I was out of there by 8:30.
That's awesome. And it was a big thing, and I was super into it. And then I would see a lot of the movies because, of course, the category was smaller.
Back then, Best Picture used to just be 5 movies.
Yeah. And then when I was in college, I kind of just was like, kind of just lost interest in it a little bit. And then was just like, whatever. I can't keep up. I've seen, you know, 2 of these 10 movies or whatever, usually. So whatever happens, happens. But yeah, it was pretty, this year, I think, was pretty fun. The previous winners thing presenting was weird. Normally it's the people from the year before for the actor category, acting and actress categories.
Yeah, who were all included? Michelle Yeoh and Ki-Hee Kwan and Jamie Lee Curtis and all them. Yeah, they were all there. Yeah, they had done this once before. It was like in 2009 or something like that. I remember it. Yeah, where they had like, you know, 5 people come out and present, like kind of introduce each nominee in the category before announcing like the winner, right?
Yeah.
And I kind of like that idea. I don't know. It's like a look back through film and Oscar history with like some people who've won in the past and all that kind of stuff, which is nice. I do think it felt, I also wanted to see the clips. That's the thing.
If they want to see the clips,
if they could do that and then also do the clips, like run them all down again and just show me the clips again. Great. That would be fine.
I think it was just weird. Like some of it was very fun. Like in particular, you know, like Jamie Lee Curtis is like clearly also good friends with Jodie Foster. So like that thing was cool. Nick Cage and Paul Giamatti, that was fun.
Yes.
But like just some of them, like Jennifer Lawrence, just like clearly was just, I'm going to read the teleprompter and get off this stage. Like just some of the people just like were so impersonal. And like Ben Kingsley's also was like that too. So it's just weird. I don't know. It's like a weird mix of like the ones that you could tell had a relationship with the person they were talking to were fun and exciting and cool.
Yeah.
And the other ones that is clearly just like, I am here.
And I think, you know, in some cases, like, I mean, Lily Gladstone is a relatively new actress who is, it's tougher to have like a past winner who has that connection to her, I guess, which I think Jennifer Lawrence is the one who introduced Lily Gladstone, right? And then, it's like Michelle Yeoh introduced Sandra Hüller and, you know, she did great. I think it seems kind of personal for Michelle Yeoh, but also like, I doubt they have much of a relationship, you know,
right,
I don't know,
yeah.
Just like that kind of thing.
But if anyone's going to sell it, it's going to be Michelle Yeoh.
Exactly, yeah. I think one of my favorites, I love Nick Cage and Paul Giamatti. Giamatti, which was great. And I went through, I was like, they must have been in a movie together at some point, right? Like I looked through it and I was like, if anybody would know, it's us.
Yeah, right.
And they were in one movie together, Mike. And I'm going to put it on you to try to figure out what movie that is.
Kiss of Death. What was that movie? No.
It was not Kiss of Death.
That'd be hilarious if it was. Oh man.
You're never gonna guess it.
I'm never gonna guess it. Is it a VOD era one?
It is not a VOD era cage. This movie did come out in theaters.
Well, Pay the Ghost.
No, that's a VOD cage.
Is it? Man, I thought that was right on the cusp. I can't remember.
Pay the Ghost was 2015, I think. That's firmly in
the
VOD.
He had 100 movies after that. That's insane.
The movie that Nick Cage and Paul Giamatti are both in is The Ant Bully.
Oh my fucking God.
Where I think Paul Giamatti plays like the guy who's trying to exterminate the ants, I think, in that movie.
I couldn't even tell you.
The ants like bite his dick. Do you remember this?
Not even this for a second.
That was like my most liked review on Letterboxd for years. So every time I like went to my profile, I was like, oh yep, there's me talking about Paul Giamatti's dick.
Classic.
Yeah, so that's one of those things where it's like, okay, they probably never actually worked together on a movie before. They should. Nick Cage and Paul Giamatti, dream team, right?
100%.
There. That'd be incredible. But yeah, I thought that was really fun. And yeah, I think there was a lot of really fun moments like that. I do think, so Jimmy Kimmel was the host again. And man, Jimmy Kimmel has to stop hosting this thing. He's
he's just like, fine.
Yeah, that's the thing.
He's serviceable.
That's the thing. I think they had a few years there where they had a couple of rough hosts. They had some bad hosts. And then they had a few years where there was no host.
Right.
When they were like, nobody wants to host this thing. We're just going to make it without a host. So I think Jimmy Kimmel is preferable to nothing, like to nobody being there.
Yeah. He's a step above nothing and Anne Hathaway and James Franco.
Yeah.
Remember that.
Yeah, I do. That was a rough time.
People, I think that was around where I was like, I don't like this anymore.
I'm done with this now.
You know what? Yeah. I've evolved beyond the need to watch the Oscars.
I don't know. They've had a few, rough hosts in the past, and Jimmy Kimmel's fine. But it is just like, every joke is like, the movies, they're too long this year. Am I right?
Yeah. Like, fucking movies. Am I right?
Yeah. Movies are too long. Kids, animated movies are for kids. Like that kind of thing. It's just like, come on. I don't know. And there was a moment in the show where John Mulaney came out to present and did like a minute and a half on Field of Dreams and crushed. And it was so good. And I have to imagine they have him like waiting to host, right? Like they
had
him waiting
in the test run, right?
Right. Like he hosted the Governor's Ball awards like 2 months ago or something, which is like an Oscars lead up kind of thing. Mm-hmm. He did great there too. I watched some clips of that and it was really good. So yeah, hopefully Mulaney next year. That'd be nice.
That'd be cool. I did appreciate the pro labor, pro union moment at the end of the opening monologue. That was pretty fun.
where they brought Kimmel. The crew out and all that kind of stuff. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was good.
All the other people that refused to cross the picket line to uphold the SAG and WGA strikes. So that was good. But yeah, otherwise, Kimmel's just like, he's a guy. He's a late night guy.
Yeah.
Sure. Be a host.
Yeah. He does good enough, but we can do better. We can bring back the golden age. We can bring back Hugh Jackman. That's my
man.
You remember that Hugh Jackman opening number, man?
Get Billy Crystal back out there. Get him back. Is he still alive?
Yeah, Billy Crystal's still alive.
Right, you never know with those guys.
I remember Billy Crystal hosted, I think in 2011, that was the last time he hosted. He hosted like 8 or 9 times.
A
bunch of times. And that was like doing it after like a very long gap. Like I think the previous year that he had hosted was like 2003 or 2004. So I remember he hosted the year that Lord of the Rings Return of the King won.
Right.
Because that was, I believe, my first Oscars. That was the first one that I watched.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I don't think I got to watch the whole thing. I think because I was 10 years old and my mom made me go to bed at a certain point. But I remember that being the one that Lord of the Rings won Best Picture, and Billy Crystal was the host then. And then he hosted again in 2011, which was the year The Artist won Best Picture. And I remember thinking like, man, Crystal doesn't have it anymore for this. It just felt very like old and hacky to me.
Ah.
But back in the 90s, it was good stuff. Yeah.
Good stuff, baby.
So yeah, I would like to see Mulaney host. I think he'd be my dream. Like he's also somebody who just seems like he's really into movies.
True.
Which helps, you know,
did a minute and a half on Field of Dreams.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So there was that. And then other just presenter bits. I did want to mention The Complete Works. All three previous seasons of The Complete Works were represented in some capacity.
We did get name dropped. You're right.
Yes. Us specifically.
They said The Complete Works pod. No O in the word works.
So Nicolas Cage was up there as part of the five best actor winners who were introducing Paul Giamatti, which that just seems like a crazy, like surreal thing in and of itself, right? Like, you know, somebody who really like fell from stardom. Like, I don't think he was at the Oscars in the last couple of years, like maybe presenting or something. I feel like
I don't remember. I don't think so.
I remember when Pig came out, we were like, he's got to get that Oscar nomination. He's got to win. And then he didn't get nominated and we were very furious.
Exactly.
But it was cool to see him like kind of back on the Oscar stage and sort of like re-embraced by Hollywood in a way. But then also, yeah, Michelle Yeoh was there, which we knew she would be there, right? Like she was announcing Best Actress and she got to introduce Sandra Hüller. But then also Jeff Goldblum got name dropped in a very funny bit that I thought between Kate McKinnon and America Ferrera, where Kate McKinnon is like, oh, but Jeff Goldblum's real, right? And like, no, no, Jeff Goldblum's not real. And then she has this line like, then to whom have I been sending my tasteful nudes?
Steven Spielberg, cut to Steven Spielberg.
Yes, cut to Steven Spielberg in the audience pointing at himself, which was very funny. Also, I like that she called him Dr. Spielberg. That was Dr. That was Spielberg, good. Sir. Is this true?
Yeah, that was fun. What else? What other stuff? I thought remember when Robert Downey Jr. used to do cocaine joke was real bad.
That was from weird. Kimmel.
That was weird.
A little odd.
Yeah. But otherwise, yeah, it was mostly pretty fine. There was no controversial things, I don't think.
No, yeah, for the most part. I know there was a couple of people kind of misreading Jonathan Glazer's acceptance speech for the Zone of Interest.
Oh, baby. We don't have time. That's a whole other podcast.
Yeah, that's a whole other podcast. But there was some controversy around that.
Yeah, around for that. Some reason. They just, what if we just forget the back half of the sentence and just cut it off right in the middle before he makes his point. And
yes,
like, that was some bullshit. Variety even published it that way. It was so weird.
Yeah,
it was like a willful misrepresentation of what he was saying.
Yeah, absolutely. But I did think, Zone of Interest won international feature, which is a very good movie and made sense. It was the only one nominated also for Best Picture.
Right.
But Zone of Interest also won Best Sound, which I was surprised by, not because I don't think it deserves it. It actually like really deserves it. But it's a much more like subtle sound design than I thought the Oscars were going to like really kind of recognize. Like I had Oppenheimer like for sure. That was like, yep, checking that one off. That felt like an easy one. And Zone of Interest took that, which was great.
I know a lot of times, I haven't seen it, but I know a lot of times in those more technical awards, because the entire Academy votes, right? It's like the one with the most sound or the most costume or whatever, you know, like whatever usually wins. So it's interesting that it's like actually like a, from what I've heard, like really artistic representation one.
I mean the sound in Zone of Interest, the sound makes the movie in Zone of Interest. That's the thing. It's a really incredible thing where you haven't seen it yet, but obviously the plot of Zone of Interest, such as it is that you're watching Rudolf Höss, who is the commandant of Auschwitz, and his wife and his family, and they're just like living next to Auschwitz, and you're just watching their lives for the most part as they live next to Auschwitz, and they're kind of going about their normal day, and the sound does this thing where like there's very very like soft, subtle, you know, horrific things happening in the background that you hear through the soundscape. You hear like screaming in the background, like in a very distant thing,
right?
Like, to a degree where like if you weren't paying attention you might not hear it, which that's kind of the idea of the movie, you know. That's right. that's part of it. And so
about hashtag themes and hashtag analysis and and hashtag aesthetics in my movie.
Correct, Mike.
Wow. Crazy to think about.
But yeah, so for Zone of Interest to win sound was a pretty good win. I was pretty excited about that. And yeah, that was one that I did not get. I also did not get the reason I did not win my Oscar ballot is because for production design and makeup and hairstyling and costume design, I was like, this is Barbie all the way. Barbie's got these.
Yeah.
And it ended up being Poor Things. Poor Things ended up taking those.
Which is wild. I mean, I haven't seen Poor Things, so I don't know, but like the production design and all that stuff of Barbie is like doing so much heavy lifting for the themes and aesthetic of that movie. But I guess also for Poor Things too.
I mean, both are equally deserving. It makes sense. I mean, if I had my way, Asteroid City would be walking away with that Oscar.
Which is insane that it's not even anywhere around here. And I wanted to talk about Wes Anderson winning the best short, right, or whatever.
So he won the best live action short for The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar, which was the first of the four Roald Dahl shorts that he made for Netflix earlier this year. And so, yeah, Wes Anderson won his first Oscar for this short film, was not there to accept it because he is about to start shooting his next movie. He's like overseas about to shoot The Phoenician Scheme, which is a perfectly Wes Anderson title.
Yes.
And Jeff Goldblum's in it. So we'll talk about it one day.
Can't wait. But yeah, I just was, I forget if I saw it in a tweet or heard it on a podcast or something, but just the idea of like being a short filmmaker and you bust your ass and you finally get, like, you get nominated for an Oscar for your, be recognized. And then also Wes Anderson is nominated for a short film.
Yep.
Like, just get hang it up at that point. Like,
That is the thing. And so here's the other thing about that. So it won the live action short film category. When they put out these shorts, I was wondering why it wasn't an anthology film or why it wasn't in like a collection of shorts that you can easily access on Netflix.
Uh-huh.
Like if you go to one of the shorts, you can't access the other three shorts until you actually go into the search bar and look up. Like, it's not like, you know, I was expecting like a TV season, like you had the four episodes in a row or whatever. Right. And they didn't do that. Like, you have to have all the individual shorts. And Wes Anderson, I think, originally announced it as like an anthology film. And I believe Netflix split it up into four shorts specifically, I think, so that they could enter it into the live action short film category.
Really?
And then yesterday or today, this like just happened right after they won the Oscar. Netflix announced that they're going to be re-releasing the Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar shorts as an anthology film on Netflix.
What? They're just like LOL JK.
Yeah.
That's crazy. That's so funny.
And I think what happened is that a few years ago, they commissioned the Coen brothers to make like in a series of shorts that became The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, became one movie. And I think their goal greenlighting that originally was like, oh, hey, we're going to get that live action short film Oscar.
Yeah, locked. The Coens locked in, of course. Yeah.
And instead, they did that with Wes Anderson. They had an anthology film that turned into shorts, and now it's back into an anthology film.
Wild. That's fascinating.
So there's some fraud going on here, is what I'm saying. But happy for Wes Anderson. It is a really good short. It's very good.
That's what I've heard.
You haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, so I haven't watched them.
Yeah, you should. It's good. Now that it's an anthology film, they're easier to access on
Netflix. Exactly. Now it was the convenience of Netflix that stopped me from... from watching them.
Other stuff throughout the ceremony, the Mulaney bit was very good. The John Cena bit I also really enjoyed.
That was good.
That was very funny, where he came out naked. And then I'm Just Ken brought the house down, I thought.
Yeah,
it was good stuff. Watching it with the crowd was fantastic. Watching it in the theater, and people were going nuts for it. The moment Slash comes out, like, people in our
it's
theater
like,
were
why
like,
is this Slash?
Yeah,
that was fun. I liked it.
Yeah, and it was just like pure joy. It reminded me of the Oscars performance of Everything is Awesome from the Lego Movie like 10 years ago. Just one of my favorite Oscars moments. And yeah, Ryan Gosling crushed it. And I liked that they had all the other Kens from the movie come out. Simu Liu was there and Kingsley Benadire. And it was just super fun. I liked when Ryan Gosling went out to the audience and Greta Gerwig was singing along and all that. It was great. Fun time.
Yeah. That was neat.
Yeah.
And the Gentlemen Prefer Blondes thing going on. That was fun.
Oh, with like the Barbie faces in the thing. Is that
really? Well, yeah, that he's in the pink, all pink, and the man the like coattail tuxedo stuff. And it's like, this is fun. I like it. I forgot what I was going to say, but it was cool. I was actually surprised that they had the other Kens in the like backup dancer troupe.
So was I. Yeah. And and the camera doesn't like focus on them that much. So I was like wondering how many people actually noticed they were there.
Yeah.
but they were, and it was cool to see them. Yeah. It was neat.
Love that for CB Liu.
Yes, absolutely. Marvel's really sleeping on doing Shang-Chi too. He might as well do this. You know?
Well, I'm free. So
yeah. But yeah, the I'm Just Ken performance was really good. The other performances were fine also. I don't know. Billie Eilish won the best original song category, also from Barbie, which, you know, it's a fine song.
I didn't even know she had a song in Barbie.
It plays over the end credits. I think it plays like three times in the movie.
It's not I'm Ken, so who cares?
I'm Just Ken is just such a big breakout song. It's so fun. It's cool. It for me, it would have been I'm Just Ken. And I also, in the mics, I did also nominate Pink, which is the song that plays at the beginning, which turns into like, you know, talking about the existential thoughts of death that Barbie is feeling.
Right.
Which is very fun. But yeah, I'm Just Ken. It's great. It was like the moment of the night, I think. Like, that whole performance was really good. Yeah. I also liked when Godzilla Minus this one won best visual effects, and the team had a bunch of little Godzilla toys that they were holding.
Yeah, that was that was awesome. I'm glad they won. Very, very touching and everything. But also, like, the most offensive and egregious playoff of the night, where these people who clearly English is not their first language, while offering a tribute to one of their team members that died before they finished the film, or I forget exactly what happened, and then they just play the, like, cut them off with the music. I mean, like, are you fucking kidding me? whoever came up with this idea is the worst.
Yes, that was really weird. But I was happy that they won at least.
Yes.
And yeah, it was cool to see. And they all had their gods. Like, I liked when they got up there and, like, the guy who was, like, going to represent them to, like, you know, do his speech, had to, like, fumble with his Godzilla toy and the Oscar and, like, kind of hand off the toy to somebody else.
It was very fun.
That was good. So I haven't seen this movie yet, but the 20 Days in Mariupol won Best Documentary Feature, which had, I think, a really terrific, like, a really stirring speech from the film's director about the Ukraine, right?
Yes.
It had what's going on in the Ukraine. And it was, like, I think, a very powerful moment that was then just transitioned into I'm Just Ken started playing, like, the instrumental version, like, as the like, they didn't play him off, I don't think, but it was just, like, that was the song that, like, led out of that speech.
Very
which
wild.
Which was weird.
Yeah, the Oscars are a strange thing.
They are a strange thing. That is very true. And then, yeah, also I did want to mention, too, one also other nice moment that I really liked. When Christopher Nolan won Best Director, I thought he gave a very good speech about, you know, how, you know, cinema's really just in its infancy. It's, you know, it's 100 years, like, 100 years old. And, like, you know, there's still so much more to do with the medium and all that kind of stuff. Steven Spielberg was the one who presented the award to him. He, like, did the, you know, the whole thing. And then when they walked off stage together, you could see them, like, they're talking, they're, like, chit-chatting or whatever. And, like, behind them, you see footage of Nolan accepting his Oscar just a few seconds ago, and then you also see footage of Steven Spielberg accepting his Oscar for Schindler's List, like, 30 years ago,
right?
And there, it's like side by side, and you're watching Steven Spielberg and Christopher Nolan walk past it, and it's like, oh man, that's a cool, like, you know, I mean, if anybody could, like, claim to be today's Spielberg in terms of, like, creating large scale blockbusters and all that kind of stuff, it's kind of Christopher Nolan, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yeah, I agree. I think that's the one of the fun parts about the Oscars, that, you know, in general, is getting to see the kind of luminaries and titans hand off these kind of awards to newer people or whatever. So that's pretty fun. Yeah, nice, touching.
Yeah, definitely. Any other moments of the Oscars, Mike, anything that stood out to you that you wanted to give a shout out to?
Not that I could think of off the top of my head. I think it was just pretty cool. The best documentary short, I think, that the Last Repair Shop one, which is pretty cool. I haven't seen that or anything, but that was just exciting because I like what that is about and how LA County is the last county in the country that gives out free musical instruments to its students, which is insane.
Right.
And then one of them was there. So that was real exciting. So yeah, I don't know. In general, it was fine.
Yeah, I liked Devendra Randolph's speech as well, and how she made Paul Giamatti cry, and that was very affecting, you know. But yeah, no, again, I think it was a pretty good ceremony. That you know, there wasn't a lot of surprises other than the actress thing for me.
Yeah,
which, you know, was a surprise. But again, Emma Stone is great in Poor Things. Like, I'm glad that if Lily Gladstone had to lose, which I do think, you know, completely divorced from my relationship to the Roxy, I do think Lily Gladstone gave the best performance I saw in 2023. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like every time I talk about it, I have to be like, I know I work at a place that might give me some bias towards that opinion, but truly, like, completely divorced from it, I really think she's fantastic and Killers. But I'm glad, like, if she had to lose, like, it was to somebody who I thought was giving a really good performance to, you know, like, if it went to, like, or at least, like, you know, a performance that felt noteworthy or whatever, like, right. if it went to, like, Annette Bening from NIAID, then I would be like, I don't know about this. This feels wrong. This feels wrong.
Feels like the fix is in.
Yes. And I'm saying that as somebody who has not watched NIAID, but that's most people. That's
and even in her speech, Emma Stone was like, you know, acknowledged Lily Gladstone and said, like, we share this together. I share this with you or something like that.
It really felt like she was not expecting to win.
Yeah.
Her
face when they announced her name was like, what has happened? Why?
Like, she had a vision of the Twitter discourse.
Exactly.
Like, her life just flashed before her eyes.
Yeah. So that was exciting, I guess, or nice that at least she was like, what the, why me? What should be you? Kind of thing. So, yeah. I mean, I guess I haven't seen a lot of the other performances, but I think that also, from what I've seen, a lot of people on Twitter and stuff, of course, with the hashtag discourse, you know, in the the what we talked about with the technical awards, like the most this, and it's like certainly the most acting.
Yes. And definitely like Emma Stone in Poor Things is a much showier performance than Lily Gladstone in Killers of the Flower Moon. That's the thing. And it's a really like technically accomplished performance. She's really great in it, but it's obvious the two performances doing very different things.
Yeah.
So yeah, is what it is. We'll see what happens. I think Lily Gladstone, like, you know, in spite of losing the Oscar, you know, it's one of those things where sometimes like you get one shot and then you're done. But I do think Lily Gladstone will be back. I think so.
Yeah.
In the years to come. I know she has been cast as the lead in a movie with a Charlie Kaufman script, which that's cool. That's exciting. And she is working on a movie with the director of The Unknown Country, which she was in and played at Montana Film Festival 2 years ago. And looking forward to that too. So there's more to come from Lily Gladstone. I think she'll be back.
I think so.
Relatively soon.
Yeah, she's got some like Hulu miniseries or something they were advertising
with Riley Keough, I think.
I think so, yeah. I was like, that's the Mike Smith household like dream team. Can't wait.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So any last thoughts about the Oscars, Mike, before you, do you want to move on to some discussions?
I think we could do some discussions.
All right. So yeah, the Oscars. Oh, also Boy and the Heron won animated feature. And I had that one. I got that one.
You got that one. Good job.
And I was betting against myself because I really thought I thought Spider-Verse was going to win, but I was like betting with my heart with Boy and the Heron, what I would like prefer to see happen.
Yeah.
I look through articles about like, you know, people predicting the Oscars and like, we're using math to figure out the Oscars. And, you know, everyone was like, Spider-Verse is going to win this thing. And I voted Boy and the Heron and I was right. So I was happy about that.
Good job.
And I thought it was funny that Hayao Miyazaki was not there, which sounded about right also.
Yeah.
But all right. Yeah. Discussions. All right, Mike D, what do you have to discuss in this today besides the Oscars?
First thing I have to discuss is 2023's Thanksgiving, directed by Eli Roth.
I have been meaning to watch this for a while. How was it?
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty fun. It's on Netflix now. Give it a little whirl. It is pretty violent, funny, silly. You know, pretty self-aware, which I was enjoying. I was pretty shocked at how modern it is and feels. Like, it looks really sleek and like a current horror movie. Like, you know, if you've seen the trailer, trailer that it's based on is this, like, really grimy and chewed up. I mean, of course, it was part of Grindhouse and all that stuff, so that's part of the aesthetic of that whole project. But I thought it would be like that, but it's not. It's just like a modern-day slasher movie, which is pretty fun. I was like, wow, this is neat. And it's got twisty-turny stuff. I think the John Carver character, who's the villain or the slasher persona stuff, is fun. So yeah, I'd say, you know, give it a whirl. If you're just like, I don't know, what am I going to do? Something I don't really want to, like, you know, if you're not in a zone of interest mood, like, let's just throw this shit on and have a fun time, have some beers or whatever. And so, yeah, I really, had a good time with Thanksgiving.
Nice. Yeah. I really wanted to see this when it came out just because I was so like, I was so impressed that, like, oh, they're still making movies based on the trailers from Grindhouse.
Yeah, it's still happening.
That's the thing. Because the Machete movies came out, like, shortly after Grindhouse happened. Right? It was, like, Machete and Machete Kills. And then Hobo with a Shotgun was right around the same time, too. Mm. And then, like, 15 years passed, and now we have Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I do want to see it. I know it's on Netflix now. I wanted to see it when it came out, and then I think it was just, like, there's so many other movies that were happening around the same time, I didn't have the time to do it.
Yeah.
But I'm glad to hear it's pretty good.
Yeah, it's good time. And Patrick Dempsey's really good in it, which is very fun.
Cool.
And he's got this, I guess he's like from Maine or whatever the hell, or New Hampshire or wherever, you know, New England thing. And he's just got this like real thick accent. It's so funny. Yeah, Thanksgiving.
Cool. All right. What else you got, Mike?
I got two more. The first thing I'll talk about is Carnival of Souls from 1962. And this is a cult horror movie that we sort of have as a connection to our upcoming first episode of the Roy Scheider season of The Complete Works. And what's her name? Candace Hilligoss is the star of Carnival of Souls and is also in the first Roy Scheider movie we'll be talking about soon.
Like you're dancing around what the name of the first Roy Scheider movie is going to be.
I don't know.
Like,
it's
a big secret.
Like it's a reveal. That's Curse of the Living Corpse.
Yes.
Is that movie.
Which I think now that you've watched both of these movies, you've seen her entire filmography.
I think she's in like one other thing or something, and it might be archival footage. But yeah, she's incredible. I don't know what happened to her. Why she didn't have a career, but Carnival of Souls is from 1962, and it's this real down and dirty Like could almost be a Mystery Science Theater movie. Like you could see that path, but there's just something to it that really elevates this movie. And okay. I don't know what it is. It might be Candace Hillegoss's performance or just the direction, but it's about this. It starts with this like group of girls, like, you know, young adults or whatever. And they're in this like kind of cool looking car, and this like group of boys pull up and they're like, "Hey babes, you want a drag race?" And they're like, "Yeah, woo," you know, smoking their cigarettes. And they drive their car. The girls end up crashing off a bridge into a river. Mm. And it's this whole thing. And they're like this search party stuff. And miraculously, Candace Hillegoss's character comes out of the river like hours later. And she's fine. And she's totally fine. But she starts being haunted by this like ghost guy. This dude, and that kind of looks like almost like a zombie from Night of the Living Dead, like just this like really caked on makeup, okay, with the big dark eyes and stuff. And she starts having visions of him there and all this stuff. And it eventually just culminates in this big like ghost haunting thing with her. It has a really great moment reveal at the end that I won't spoil necessarily, but it's pretty fun. And yeah, so it's just this kind of, and it's like 78 minutes. Or it's like one of those kind of things that's just shoestring budget from the Midwest regional, yeah, actors thing. And it's just really weird and nightmarish. And it really feels like you can kind of see the kind of like cult influence on a lot of modern stuff or like David Lynch things. I think I mentioned to you that like, oh, I understand where episode 8 of Twin Peaks: The Return came from.
Really?
Because okay. It's got that kind of vibe to it. But like the super early proto version of that nightmare logic thing going on. So yeah, Carnival of Souls, big recommend. It's on Criterion Channel. It's on, they have a disc of it, and it's the version on Criterion Channel is the full, like has all the commentaries, has the special features.
Oh, nice.
It's one of those things on the channel. So if you're interested in that, check out Carnival of Souls.
Rad. Yeah, I do want to watch this. I was kind of looking, like reading into it because of the Roy Scheider season and because of the Candace Hillegoss connection. And yeah, it looks awesome. Like it looks like a movie that was like completely like, you know, when it came out, nobody cared about it. Like didn't really hit at all. And then like in the '80s, it suddenly got kind of a resurgence and people started like really paying attention to it. I believe it's in the public domain also. So really you can probably watch it anywhere if you wanted to.
Yeah. If you want to check out the nice, you know, restored HD version, check it out on Criterion, but it's probably on YouTube somewhere.
There you go.
Yeah. And they like filmed it at this big portion of it at this like abandoned Mormon amusement park in Utah that the director apparently was driving across country and was like, screeched to a halt on the side of the highway. It was like, what is that building? Like, we need to write a movie about it. And it's just really creepy and decrepit and weird. Carnival of Souls.
Very cool. All right, you got one more, Mike?
One more. Also a Criterion Channel watch, and that is 1978's The Silent Partner.
Ooh.
Ooh. Which, have you ever seen this movie, Mike?
No, but I think I saw some people talking about it on Twitter. It's like Elliot Gould and...
Yes.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And Christopher Plummer. Yeah, and it's just like the hot, young, sexy Elliot Gould, which is so funny. And also hot, young, sexy Christopher Plummer. Like, what is going on?
Yeah.
But yes, Elliot Gould plays a bank teller who realizes somebody is going to rob his bank, rob his window specifically. Puts it together, and it's like the first, you know, 15, 20 minutes of him... how he does that and what when he realizes it and what's going to happen. So he devises this plan. Basically, it's sort of like if you paired it with Charlie Varrick, it's like the same movie, but in opposite sides of the thing. So he realizes that this is going to happen. So he basically like brings a bag to work that day and starts, instead of putting money in the drawer, is stashing it in this bag. So when the guy comes to rob his drawer, his window, it's like $1,000 in the drawer, but all the receipts say $50,000. So the guy gets away with $1,000, but he's reporting, $50,000 got stolen, boss. I don't know. And he keeps the money for himself. And then Christopher Plummer, who is the guy that robs him, realizes, of course, that he's been ripped off. And then it's about him hunting down Elliot Gould and them cat and mouse together over this missing money, which Charlie Varrick is when they rob the bank. And they get away with like $1,000,000 and it's reported like only 50,000 got stolen. And they're like, oh shit, this is mob money.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like the opposite side of the spectrum. Silent Partner. And it's awesome. There was a review on Letterboxd that was like, you know, 25% cat and mouse with Elliot Gould and Christopher Plummer, 75% hot women throwing themselves at Elliot Gould. And it's definitely that.
Yeah.
But it is very fun and just like a pretty tense, you know, crime thriller from the 70s with Elliot Gould. So The Silent Partner.
Sounds awesome.
Also a Christmas movie.
Also a Christmas movie? What? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sounds great. Sounds right up my alley.
Absolutely. Okay. You would love it.
Silent Partner on Criterion Channel now. And then, that's all you got, right, Mike?
I've been
Helldivers too.
And also Helldivers 2.
Sure. Still plugging that one.
Yeah, new patch dropped today, so I'm jonesing to finish recording so I could go kill some bugs.
Fair enough. All right, so I'll talk about just a few movies then. Also, first want to give a shout out to a movie that you watched a few weeks ago, Mike, and that is Sexy Beast.
Oh, nice.
Which, speaking of Jonathan Glazer, who directed The Zone of Interest, just won an Oscar the other night. Sexy Beast was his first feature film, and it's on the Criterion Channel right now. They have a Jonathan Glazer collection. I'm planning to watch Birth soon as well. That's right now the only one of his features I haven't seen yet. But yeah, Sexy Beast, great. Just a really wild, fun crime thriller. A real 180 from Zone of Interest.
From what I've seen, like, I can't believe it's the same person.
But at the same time, like, watching Sexy Beast, I was like, and knowing, like, I've seen Under the Skin and I've seen Zone of Interest. I have not seen Birth yet, and I feel like that will complete the puzzle. But I can sort of see the transition, like, across those four films. Like, I could sort of see it happening. But yeah, Sexy Beast is terrific. It's just a super fun crime thriller, and Ben Kingsley is giving one of the best performances I've ever seen in anything. He's amazing in it. He's so good.
I think about that moment when he comes back from the airport and he's just like, no, like that. Yeah, that whole scene is just fucking insane. I think about it all the time since I've watched it.
It's bananas. He's so good. And the only thing I can say against the movie is that at some point Ben Kingsley leaves it, and it's still very good, but it's not as good because Ben Kingsley's not there anymore. Like, if you had that high
yeah
with that character, and then he's gone. But yeah, I had a blast watching Sexy Beast. Thought it was super fun.
I think you get, once Ben Kingsley leaves, you get Ian McShane though, right?
That's true. Yeah, Ian McShane pops up, and I didn't realize he was in the movie, so I was excited to see him too.
Yeah. Nice. I'm glad you liked it.
Yes. But yeah, Sexy Beast on Criterion Channel right now. And then also want to recommend Perfect Days, which is the new film from Wim Wenders. This was nominated for the Oscar for Best International Film the other night, and it lost its Zone of Interest. But Wim Wenders, director of movies like Paris, Texas, Until the End of the World, Wings of Desire. Yeah, this is a new movie. It takes place in Japan. It is a slice of life drama about a guy who is a toilet cleaner in Japan. Like, his job is just, he's a public toilet cleaner, and you're just watching him go about his day, pretty much. Wow. You're just kind of hanging out with this guy as he cleans toilets. And it's sort of like four or five short stories, like, all kind of centered on this guy, but it's not really like giving you like a ton of like plot or anything. It's just like, this is what this guy's life is like. This is what, these are the people that he interacts with. And it's a delight. It's just a very like wonderful film, life affirming in a weird way. Great soundtrack. A big part of the movie is that he has these like old cassette tapes that he just listens to in his car. And yeah, there's this great Japanese version of House of the Rising Sun that plays at one point, which is very, very good. Of course they play Perfect Day by Lou Reed at some point, 'cause how could you not? it's a really, really terrific movie. Just had a great time with it. So Perfect Days, go check it out.
Nice. Yeah. I hadn't heard about this movie. I don't really know, but yeah, somebody recently was tweeting about it or something, and I was like, oh damn, I gotta check this movie out. It looks cool.
Yeah. It's very, very good. And you've seen, Until the End of the World, right? Like, you,
yes, I have, yes, the Criterion. Yeah.
Oh, nice. I have not seen that yet. That's like the 5.5 hour, sci-fi movie he made, right?
I was going to say, if you were going to use it for a movie day, you would get to watch that and one other movie. Right. Because there's the 5.5 hour. I think it has the theatrical cut on the disc, but it also has the crazy 5 hour one.
Right, which is the one that like you're supposed to watch theoretically,
yeah,
right?
That's the director's cut or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, Until the End of the World, I hear it's really good too. One of these days, I'll get around to it.
Yeah, it was awesome.
But yeah, Perfect Days, really terrific. So yeah, we were playing it at the Roxy this past week. I'm sure there's other places you can watch it now at this point, but that's where I saw it. And then wanted to mention two other movies that I watched recently. The first of which is from 1950. It's a noir film from Nicholas Ray, director of Rebel Without a Cause and several other movies as well, In a Lonely Place, which stars Humphrey Bogart and Gloria Graham. Have you seen this movie, Mike?
I have the Criterion, haven't opened it yet.
Okay.
Because I really liked They Live by Night, which is also a Nicholas, yes, Ray movie.
Yeah, that's a good movie too. But yeah, In a Lonely Place stars Humphrey Bogart as this Hollywood screenwriter who is kind of down on his luck. He's like out of work and he's like just really, really shitty. He's a really shitty dude.
In a Lonely Place?
He's in a lonely place, yeah. And then one night he meets this girl, and the girl like comes back to his house with him, and he really like brings her there just so she can like read the book that he's supposed to be adapting into a screenplay.
Okay.
And she does, and then she leaves his house, and then the next day, turns out the girl was murdered at some point that night.
Whoa.
And the police suspect Humphrey Bogart of doing it. But his neighbor, played by Gloria Graham, saw him see her off and like she left the house. And so she's like his witness to him not like to clearing his
alibi.
Yeah, exactly. But then they form a relationship, Humphrey Bogart and his neighbor. And then she starts to wonder, did he actually kill this girl? And it's really cool. It's really intense. Humphrey Bogart is amazing in it. He's really scary in it, which is not something I usually associate with Humphrey Bogart. Like, usually he's like, you know, unflappable detective guy, you know, that's right. Like his thing. And he's very good at that. And it really feels like a performance that is letting him stretch into doing a lot of other different things. And so, yeah, In a Lonely Place, it rules. It's really, really terrific. And yeah, if you've got the Blu-ray, Mike, I highly recommend watching it as soon as you can.
Yeah, I'll have to check it out. That sounds cool. I think I snapped it up in one of those 50, you know, flash sale things. I was like, sure. Oh man. And then it just went on the pile.
Yeah, fair enough. I watched it on Tubi with ads. So there was that. The ads were pretty artfully placed into the movie, I gotta say, though.
Oh, that's good.
There's a lot of moments in the movie where it just kind of dissolves into the next scene, and that's when the ads would pop in. Mm. So I'd be like, okay, yeah, this feels like a natural break point for...
Did you see that thing going around that, like, where was it? Like, Chilean or South American Star Wars broadcast thing? Did you see that?
Oh, yes. Yeah, where... like they would like put the ads into the movie or something. Yeah. So like there's a moment when Obi-Wan like reaches for Anakin's lightsaber to give to Luke, and it's just like grabbing a beer out of the fridge.
Yeah, it's like opening a cooler and taking a beer out. It's so funny.
Very, very good. All right. And then I have one last movie I want to talk about, Mike. As you know, I've mentioned in the podcast before, I've been watching all the Buster Keaton movies.
Yes.
I've been watching all the movies that Buster Keaton directed to kind of keep up with Blank Check, who did
from
their
a year ago.
From a year ago. like 10 months ago.
Okay.
Like, come on. Blank Check with Griffin and David, they did a whole Buster Keaton series, and I realized that I had only actually seen The General out of those movies. So I'm making my way through them. I'm almost done. And I wanted to give a shout out to Steamboat Bill Jr., which have you seen Steamboat Bill, Mike?
I think so. I was going to say, I think the only two I've seen are The General and Steamboat Bill, but I don't know for sure.
Gotcha. Well, this is the one that has the famous house falling down on Buster Keaton stunt. And so that's like a stunt that I knew about like way before the movie. Obviously it's been recreated in so many different things. There's a great Arrested Development episode that like recreates that stunt, which is fun. But I assumed, because that's the famous stunt, because it's like the big thing, because like, you know, Buster Keaton like could have easily died doing that. Like it's like 2 tons of wood.
Yeah, that's like an actual side of a house.
It's an actual side of a house. It's like not just like, you know, plywood or something. This is like the real... This is the real thing. And so, yeah, he could have easily died doing it. And so I assumed, well, that's got to be like the last thing you see in the movie. Like the movie will be building up to this. And instead what happens is like, that's like a pretty incidental moment in like a 30 minute climax where like this hurricane is hitting the town and like a lot of stuff is going on. There's a moment when like Buster Keaton like grabs onto a tree and the tree lifts up into the air and he's just like flying.
Yeah.
And again, like I talked about Sherlock Jr. when I watched that, and there were so many moments in this movie where I was like, how the hell did they do that?
Yeah.
This is 1927 or whatever. Like it boggles the mind. It's a really great silent comedy. It's really fun. And the stunt work is unbelievable. It's cool to watch.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing with all those comedies, just in general, like on top of being you know, delightful and whimsy and also very romantic and sweet in some of them. Just like how they do that though.
Yeah, how do they do that?
And sometimes it's they drop half of a house on somebody.
So, yeah, sometimes just we literally dropped a house and just hoped he was standing in the right spot.
we think we know trigonometry, so you should be fine.
Yeah.
But maybe not.
So it was really fun to watch. And actually, I'll give a shout out to another Buster Keaton movie, College, which was
College.
The name of the movie is College. And I want to give a shout out to that one specifically because on the Blank Check episode, they didn't like College that much. And I thought College was hilarious. I thought College was really, really funny. Like half the movie is Buster Keaton trying out for sports at his college and being bad at them. And every time I was like, this is good. This is good stuff. I had a really funny, I thought College was really funny, and I think it's based on the Blank Check episode, maybe underrated. People should go watch College.
Mm.
And all the best Keatons are on YouTube. They're easily available.
Nice. Isn't there a famous Harold Lloyd movie that's like football and college and stuff, right? That's
That sounds right. Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Maybe The Freshman or something like that.
I think it is The Freshman. Yeah, I've only seen Safety Last from Harold Lloyd, which is fantastic. But I'm pretty sure The Freshman would be that movie. That sounds correct.
Yeah. I don't know. I just think it's interesting that there's just like was a genre at some point. It's like guy goes to college. Yeah. Guy tries to play football in college.
I think college like really kind of took off around this time. That's sort of the
could
like,
be it.
Like yeah. The concept of college became a thing that was like, oh yeah, no, people should go to this or whatever. Like
everybody can go to this. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It was a lot easier to do back then.
Yes.
So there's that too. The Freshman is the name of the movie. Harold Lloyd is a college freshman trying to become popular by joining the school football team.
There it is.
And I believe this is 1925, so it's like a year or two before Buster Keaton's college.
What a hack.
Yeah, Keaton totally ripped Lloyd off. But there it is. All right, and that's all my discussions, Mike. I'm out of my stuff. We did it.
Another week, we talked about every single thing we possibly could have.
Exactly. So Mike D, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at MD Film Blog on Twitter, Letterboxd, and Blue Sky. And if you would like to donate to support the show, you could do that on our Ko-fi page, which is ko-fi.com/MikeAndMikePods, where you can donate $50 to dictate an episode for us, pick a topic, which we have two lined up now. We talked about last week. We are going to be watching Star Trek First Contact. And then we also got another one for another DBZ episode. We know how exciting we are. Also, RIP Akira Toriyama.
Yes. We've talked about Dragon Ball in the past. So somebody paid to make us watch Dragon Ball Super Broly. And that's when I got to really just talk about Dragon Ball nonstop for an hour.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I was very saddened by the passing of Akira Toriyama. As I mentioned then, I've been rewatching Dragon Ball just over the past like 2 years on and off kind of. Mm-hmm. I've watched all of Dragon Ball. I'm now deep into Dragon Ball Z. I'm in season 3 of 9 seasons. There's still a lot to go. There's still a lot to go. But I've really enjoyed the rewatch over the last couple of years. And so I'm glad they'll have another chance to talk about it in the wake of Akira Toriyama's passing.
Yes. Yeah, very sad. But yeah, I'm excited to watch my second ever Dragon Ball movie. I guess I'll talk about it on that episode, but I did watch, maybe like 10 episodes of Dragon Ball, the first 10.
That's more than I thought you did, actually.
Yeah, I kind of got in there for a while, and then I was like, I don't know.
If you watched like 3 more episodes, you will have finished like the first saga of Dragon Ball. Like the first one's like 13 episodes.
Okay, I guess I'll go back and finish.
You got to see what Pilaf wishes for, right? You got to see what the first wish is, basically.
I guess.
Yeah, just throwing it out there. But all right, you can find me online at M Smith Film Blog on Twitter, Mike Smith Film on Letterboxd, Radio Mike Sandwich Instagram, and M Smith Film Blog on Blue Sky as well. Thank you for listening to Mike and Mike Go to the Movies. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DiCrescio. Don't forget to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or any other podcast app. And if you want to contact us, you can tweet at us at Mike and Mike Pod. You can find the rest of our podcast and Rapture Press alongside many other podcasts, all kinds of comic books and movie news and all that good stuff. Next week, it's going to be Mike Makes Mike Watch. This time around, Mike D is finally making me watch Puss in Boots, The Last Wish.
Yes. We're getting back in the boots. I don't know what I was.
I guess, should I watch Puss in Boots 1, Mike? I've never seen it.
What? I guess so. I haven't seen it in 10 years or whatever since it came. So, but it'd be fun. Yeah, let's do both. It'd be fun.
I will take it under advisement. We'll see. Okay. I still got to catch up with some Star Trek movies before I get into First Contact. I just keep adding more stuff to my plate. Now we're watching these Roy Scheider movies. But yeah, Puss in Boots, The Last Wish. Mike D's going to make me watch that one. And then I'm making Mike D watch 2016's Swiss Army Man, which is the first feature-length film from the Daniels, who directed Everything Everywhere All at Once. I was kind of surprised. Not surprised. I remember just Mike D, I think, missed it when it came out. But like, Mike D loves Everything Everywhere so much.
Yeah.
And hasn't seen Swiss Army Man. I figured now's the time.
Might as well. Yeah, got to complete the oeuvre.
Yeah, exactly. And it's Oscar season, so we'll talk about a movie that was completely ignored by the Oscars, but whose directors then made a movie that was very big at the Oscars.
Yeah, didn't they? I feel like their new project recently got announced or something. The Daniels.
Oh, was it?
I think so, but I don't remember anything, actually.
I'm going to look it up right now, real quick. We're going to make Kyle continue listening to this while I figure this out.
Nobody can vamp like Mike Smith can vamp. Look at you go.
So upcoming projects. As of 2022, the Daniels signed a first look TV deal with A24. They also have a 5-year film deal with Universal Pictures. And in March 2023, it was revealed they directed one episode of Star Wars Skeleton Crew, which is going to be an upcoming Disney Plus Star Wars show. But yeah, nothing on their Wikipedia about a new movie announcement yet. Okay. So
then I guess not.
We'll see what happens. You never know.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll break up and do like what, solo Daniels work. So just be Daniel.
A Daniel.
A Daniel. From the twisted mind of A Daniel.
Oh man, John Krasinski, what a guy.
Yes. I forgot forgot he got the, I believe John Krasinski got From the Imagination of John Krasinski.
I think you're right. Yeah.
No, it was Matthew Vaughn got From the Twisted Mind of Matthew Vaughn Argyle. which honestly, if that trailer had not said From the Twisted Mind, I don't think Argyle would have had nearly the backlash that it did. Right?
I don't think. Yeah. Although maybe, I don't know. Everything I've heard about that movie is bananas.
I think it largely would have been ignored. I haven't seen it, but I think it largely would have just been ignored. But because the trailer played so often, and because it said From the Twisted Mind of Matthew Vaughn,
it became like a hate watch thing. You're talking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But yeah, what were you gonna say, Mike?
I just said maybe.
Maybe. Anyway, next week, Mike's Makes Mike Watch, Swiss Army Man, Puss in Boots: Last Wish. In the meantime, the Complete Works will be returning soon with season 4 for our Roy Scheider season. So stay tuned for updates on that one. I believe the Nicolas Cage film Arcadian just premiered at South by Southwest.
Yes.
What I forgot about, or maybe didn't even realize, it's from the director of The Trust, which Nicolas Cage was in. Yeah, which is a pretty high point in the Cage VOD era, I think.
Yeah,
right?
That made my top 10, The Trust, I think.
I think you were really into The Trust, yeah.
I really liked that movie, yeah.
It's a good movie, yeah. So from the director of The Trust, it's like a post-apocalyptic horror film. So yeah, just premiered South by Southwest and hearing pretty good things. I believe it's coming out in April, so let's talk about that soon. That's going to be coming up.
Can't wait.
And that is the end of this week's episode of Mike and My Go to the Movies. We will see you on the other side.